might not have gotten news about, but there was a case of voter fraud that we investigated in the last election in 2010. And when we found evidence of it, we quickly turned that over to the local prosecutor and Attorney General Mike DeWine, and we're going to prosecute that case because we're sending a message right now that if we find it, if you commit fraud, when you look at 2012, we're coming after you and we're going to prosecute you to the full extent of the law. We won't have none of that.
That's Secretary of State John Husted speaking at a Republican dinner in July. His speech was used by the liberal group Progress Ohio in a video intended to demonstrate how, out of nearly some 4 million votes cast in Ohio in 2010, just one was a documented case of fraud. So, is voting reform necessary or not? And are the provisions in House Bill 194, touted by Republicans as a voting reform bill, the way to go about it? Or, as Democrats and others suggest, does HB 194 suppress the vote? We welcome back two guests to talk about that today. Joining us, Dan Tokaji. He teaches law at The Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. He's also a senior fellow at the nonpartisan Election Law at Moritz Project. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Thank you so much for having me in.
Also, Robert Clegg. Bob is a Republican strategist and senior vice president of Midwest Communications and Media. He was formerly the assistant secretary of state and held high-level administrative staff positions for the Ohio Senate and the Ohio House of Representatives. Glad you could be with us today, Bob.
Thank you, Ann.
So, for our listeners, we want to know, how do you vote? Do you vote early? Do you vote absentee ballot? Did you vote more in the last few years because of the different rules that have been in place, or did it not matter to you? Do you want to have more options for voting by absentee ballot? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, the measure, House Bill 194, is set to become law September 30th, mm-hmm. unless Democrats, liberal groups, and labor unions manage to gather about 232,000 signatures to put a repeal of the law on the November 2012 ballot. So, just in terms of mechanics and what that means, before we get into the details of the law, what does it mean if they get enough signatures? What happens, Dan?
If they get enough signatures, then the law will not go into effect until the 2012 election, at which time we'll be voting on a referendum, presuming they get enough signatures, on whether or not to accept the legislature's changes to our election laws or to reject them. It'll be a straight up and down vote, assuming they get the, by my count, 231,147 signatures that are needed in order to qualify the referendum for the 2012 ballot.
And if they do get enough signatures, Bob Clegg, the law won't go into effect until it's voted on, or until
yes.
after it's voted on and it fails or whatever happens.
Which means we will be under the current law, which means that early voting absentee ballots can go out 35 days prior to the general versus 21 days, which is the new law says. So this year it's a little confusing. Until the 29th, we won't know for sure, for this year, when those absentee ballots are going to be going out.
And from a political point of view, how does that affect the dynamics of a campaign?
Well, what has happened since the law, the changes that took effect in 2005, which opened up the whole absentee and early voting system here in Ohio, because previously it was pretty much intended for older people who couldn't physically get to the polls, and it was used mostly by those individuals. But in 2005, they opened it up, and you could do it for any reason, and a lot of people took advantage of it. It slowly started growing, and what happened with campaigns then is we're starting to develop two different campaigns, an early voting campaign. And this is something that has been going on for years in other states like Texas, where you had early voting already going on. So you have an early voting campaign that takes effect, 35 days or 40 days prior to the election, where you're trying to build up that name awareness of your candidate or your issue so that when the ballots go out, individuals will have some background knowledge about the candidate or the issue. And then you kind of pare it back down, and then towards the end, the actual election day, it goes back up again. So we've changed our campaign techniques somewhat to take into account the greater number of people that vote in that earlier period.
And if I might put this
sure,
in
Dan.
A broader context, as you suggested, this is part of a nationwide trend. Ohio, along now with most states, has what we call no-excuse absentee voting, meaning that you don't need an excuse, for example, having a disability or being out of town in order to cast an absentee ballot. And we've seen in Ohio and other states the number and percentage of people voting absentee mushroom over the years, so that in Ohio in the 2010 election, roughly 25% of the ballots that were cast via absentee ballot. Some other states, actually a majority of people are now voting absentee.
But did that mean that that increased the overall number of people who voted, or did it just change the method of voting?
This is the million-dollar question, and I think to be fair, the social science research is not entirely clear on this point. There's some evidence that expanded mail voting increases turnout, and expanded absentee voting generally, including in-person absentee voting, which other states call early voting, that it increases turnout. But I think it's fair to say the jury is still out on this. Where the effect tends to be the most evident is in lower turnout elections, right? Local elections or elections in where there are just state issues on the ballot as opposed to federal elections.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guests are Dan Tokaji, a law professor at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. Also Bob Clegg, Republican strategist and senior vice president of Midwest Communications and Media. We're talking about House Bill 194. Bob, what about that? I mean, what's your sense about, do more people turn out? Do more of a certain kind of voter turn out? What do we know, or what do you think we know?
I think I agree with Dan that I think we don't know for sure if the actual numbers have increased. I have my own personal opinion. I don't think it really has. I think what it's done is it's allowed, when you're talking about either an issue or a candidate race, the opposing sides, it's given them a better tool to turn out their vote, turn it out early. And I think it's been very useful for both political parties to have that early voting period there. I think where you would see more of a change, I think, in turnout is if you went to a online system of voting, which I know nobody really does yet, but there's some thought about trying to do that with military ballots and as almost like a test project and then see if it works and if there's the security systems in place to do it. I think if you go to something like online voting, I think you could maybe see then a greater participation rate because that becomes just so much easier for individuals to vote. However, you also have to realize there's always going to be a certain number of people that just don't want to participate, no matter how easy you make it.
Yeah, and I think what the social science evidence tends to show is that the one reform that systematically across states has been proven to increase turnout is same-day registration or election-day registration, which a number of states have. Some of them have had it now for decades. That is the one election change that really does make a significant increase in turnout that's been proven over and over again by social scientists, somewhere along the lines of a 5 to 10% increase, which may not sound like much, but in the world of election reforms, that's huge.
Well, campaigns have been lost by much less than 5 or 10%
sure.
No
question.
Of the vote.
A lot of races are lost by much less than that, yeah.
From a practical point of view, besides the political issues and the kind of work that you do, Bob Clegg, if they do get enough valid signatures by September 29th, House Bill 194 does not go into effect for this year's election, would that put a lot of pressure on boards of elections to gear up? I mean, are they already trying to prepare their ballots now but can't and they have to wait? And does that make much of a difference?
I suspect most boards of election are probably operating on the assumption that the referendum is going to qualify and that they're going to have to gear up their absentee voting process to start 35 days before the election as it has in past years. I mean, if you were a prudent member of a board of elections, that's exactly what you'd be doing.
But I think the Secretary of State has been working with the boards of elections to ensure that if there isn't enough signatures, this new law does take effect. Because if there isn't enough signatures submitted by the 29th, then it becomes law on the 30th. And we have an election here on November 8th. So, I mean, the boards have to be ready to get this election
one way or the
done.
Other.
Yeah.
And if they don't get enough signatures this time, is this the sort of thing that you see popping up again in the future, that it'll just keep coming back again and again and again?
Yeah, and we could talk. I'm sure we could talk more about this and probably get into some disagreements. But I think, you know, we've seen since 2000 major battles being waged over the rules governing elections, everything from voting machines to voter registration to provisional voting to, of course, voter ID. This is part of this battle, and I don't see this letting up any time in the future. I think this is going to be a continuing feature of our electoral landscape.
And let's remember, Ann, that we don't have the big gun here in this. We don't have photo ID.
That was taken out.
That was taken out. And, I mean, that's an issue that I don't think is gone either and could be coming back in the future. And, you know, obviously, components of this bill, if it is eventually repealed, I think will be coming back.
Yeah, we, of course, already have a voter identification requirement. This would be a much stricter one, which, to his credit, Secretary of State Husted came out in opposition to, despite the support for it among members of his party in the legislature.
So and support among Ohioans, because Quinnipiac just did a poll a couple months ago, and in that they asked, do you support a photo ID? And you know, over 70% of Ohioans said yes.
And that, I think, is even more reason why we should be thankful to Secretary of Husted for doing the right thing on this issue and coming out against a measure that was sure to disenfranchise a lot of people, especially poor people and people of color.
So let's talk about what, right now, what do you have to bring to the polls in order to vote?
Yeah. The current rule, which has been the rule since the legislation that was adopted by the Ohio legislature in 2005, is actually more than what federal law requires. It requires all voters to present some form of identification. Could be a photo ID, but it could also be something like a utility bill, a bank statement, a government document with your name and current address. Now, these are things that most voters have. You can also provide the last four digits of your Social Security number or your driver's license number, which can then be matched against data in the state's database to verify your identity. So we've got a stricter identification law on the books already than what federal law requires. Fortunately, it's one that, as far as I can tell, has not had the effect of preventing people from voting and having their votes counted.
So what had been proposed in 194 and was removed and is probably, sure, as you pointed out, probably going to pop up again as well, what would that have done?
That would the photo ID.
Yeah, Bob.
It would show like you would have to show literally either a state ID with your name and photo on it, or a driver's license with your picture and your information on it. It would require you to show something, an official ID, government ID with a picture on it.
A government-issued photo ID, but certain forms of identification, not accidentally, were excluded. Most notably, student ID, even from a state university, was deliberately excluded from the bill. You can probably figure out the math here. This was a Republican-sponsored bill, and of course, students tend to swing Democrat.
Well, also, student IDs are the easiest ones to counterfeit.
Counterfeit.
Yeah,
where's
so that's
the
why.
Evidence that a photo ID law was necessary, Bob Clegg?
No, I think it was more or less, if you have to show a photo ID to cash a check at Target, the thought was, well, then why wouldn't you have to show a photo ID when you're trying to cast a ballot?
The answer to that is simple, because voting is a fundamental right. It is a right that many people fought for, lost their lives for, and it is precisely for that reason that unnecessary burdens on the right to vote should not be tolerated. And the answer to your question, Ann, is there was absolutely no evidence of people going to the polls pretending to be someone they're not. As I said at the time, you didn't have to be an election law professor like me to figure out what was going on. This was a clear instance of Republicans controlling the legislative process and trying to pass a law that would make it more difficult for Democrats to vote.
I don't think there's any evidence that Democrats are, by and large, the individuals that don't have photo IDs.
Actually, there is evidence to that effect. What study after study has shown is that people of low income are disproportionately likely to lack the required identification, and that includes people who are minorities, because minorities, by and large, statistically speaking, are more likely to be of low income. And that, of course, makes sense, right? If you don't have a car, you're less likely to have a driver's license, which is the most common
form of ID. If you don't have a checking account, you're less likely to have
it. Exactly right. And Republicans, we can't kid ourselves here. Republicans knew this was the case at the time that they enacted the law, and enacted it precisely because of this effect.
We're going to return to this conversation about House Bill 194. I hope you'll join us. We have a couple calls if you want to email us. You can go to the address allsides@wosu.org. You can call us at 614-292-8513. Bob Clegg, Republican strategist, and Dan Tokaji, election law professor at OSU, are with us today. We hope you'll join us, too. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and time is running out on your opportunity for a Chefs in the City Ohio beer tasting. Visit WOSU.org/chefs right now and reserve your tickets. The event is in the Outdoor Beer Garden at the historic Granville Inn, and the event is tomorrow. Local food hors d'oeuvres will be paired with a selection of beers from some of Ohio's best breweries. Tickets are $45 each. Visit WOSU.org/chefs to reserve your seat now.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
72 degrees with sunny skies today and a high of 85 degrees. Clouds moving in later today, bringing a chance of showers and thunderstorms mainly after 5 o'clock tonight. And then showers tonight, an overnight low of 56. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking about House Bill 194. It's going to go into effect on September 30th, all kinds of different changes to the voting law in the state of Ohio. We're going to get to those issues soon. We just want to kind of wrap up the discussion about photo ID and identification at the polls in general. If you have a question or comment for our guests, Bob Clegg, Republican strategist and senior vice president of Midwest Communications and Media, give us a call. Also, Dan Tokaji. He teaches election law at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. And Arthur in Westerville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. You wanted to talk about photo ID some more?
Yes, ma'am. In the interest of full disclosure, I'm an active Republican and a member of the Delaware County Central Committee of the GOP.
Okay, thanks.
However, in my other incarnation, I do pro bono work in our largely illegal Latino community. And I've had occasion to deal with Matricular, the Mexican national photo ID, which also includes a thumbprint and I believe a magnetic strip. And one notes that since that went into the effect in Mexico, the one party which controlled Mexico for I think it was 71 years got to be out of power. Since that's been in, there's a real chance that the party that succeeded them will change places with them. While we've never had, even in the darkest days of Tammany Hall, the kind of corruption that was commonplace in Mexico, mm-hmm. photo ID is, I think, is a proven way to make sure that we don't get it either.
Are you convinced that it's needed, though, here in the United States?
I think it's a reasonable precaution. I think there's a tendency among Republicans to think that 1960 is forever and that the only way Democrats ever win anything is by stealing the vote. I don't earnestly believe that's true myself. However, I know for a fact I had a client who was importuned after Acorn was supposedly disbanded, was importuned to register to vote even though he wasn't a citizen. He knew better than to do that because the citizenship was pending. I don't know how many other cases there were of that. I think that both parties should be concerned that the franchise is as sacred as possible. We don't want the kind of fiascos that we had in Florida or the rampant corruption that has occurred in under Tammany Hall in the past and in other big cities in this country. We can't afford to have that.
Okay.
You will note that while people made all kinds of aspersions on Mr. Obama's parentage, nobody suggested that the election was stolen 3 years ago. People said a whole lot of nasty things about Mr. Clinton on that ground. Even though it was a close election, nobody suggested it was stolen.
Okay.
And that's important.
Dan Tokaji?
So a couple points. First, I appreciate the listener's candor on two things. First, that Mexico is very different from the United States. There is a great deal of corruption, or has been, in recent Mexican elections, not here. Secondly, I appreciate the reader's acknowledgement that Republicans have often exaggerated the existence of fraud. Sometimes, I would suggest, to the benefit of their party or their attempted benefit, magnifying the existence of fraud in an effort to pass measures that will prevent people from voting. The reality in the United States is that we don't have a national ID. There are a lot of people who have big questions about that. And at present, having to do with privacy, among other things, at present there are approximately 11% of the people. The estimates have been lower, as high and as high as 20%, but the best estimate is around 11% of people who don't have government issued photo ID, predominantly people of low income, people of color. These are groups that are already underrepresented in our electorate. The last thing we want to do is enact unnecessary measures that will make it more difficult for folks to vote.
I like the caller, talking about the use of the word fraud in elections, and he was polite enough not to mention the 2000 election where Democrats and liberals used that as a point of try to delegitimize President Bush's election. The problem here is this is always this photo ID. Coming from the other side is always the assumption we don't have voter fraud. And they'll say, well, we really don't have it. And, in the mere fact that we don't see it often confirms that. Well, we just had an instance here in Columbus based on a 2009 ballot issue on casinos where a woman was just found guilty of falsifying a couple absentee ballot applications. And there were other individuals that may have been involved. However, the county prosecutor didn't feel confident enough to proceed because of the handwriting expert that they had, couldn't definitively say that the signatures that were under question were actually falsified. We also had an instance in 2008 here in Columbus where we had a number of campaign volunteers for a certain presidential candidate who all listed one address, about 15 people, and we're all going to vote absentee out of that one address.
And Bob's comment actually points out the great irony of the proposed identification bill, which thankfully didn't pass, right? There are occasional instances of voter fraud, but nowadays they almost always involve mail-in absentee ballots, like the examples Bob gave. What they don't involve is people going to the polls pretending to be someone they are not. Voter impersonation fraud. Yet that is the only.
How do we know?
That is
how do we know
you
that?
Haven't shown it.
But if they're doing it successfully, how would you know?
And over again for evidence. In the Indiana case, supporters of photo ID submitted loads of evidence. They could not come up with a single case in the entire history of the state of Indiana
of voter impersonation fraud in person. How do you prove a negative, right, Bob?
It's actually proving a positive.
And by the way, Arthur in Westerville, thanks for that call. It is, but why now? What's the magic, to kind of wrap up the voter ID issue, because it's not in House Bill 194, just to remind listeners, we're not talking about that in terms of House Bill 194, and we want to get to that. But why now? What was the magic? And as far as 2000 goes, the entire country was riveted on the fear that suddenly this election system that we brag about around the world was faulty.
Yeah, and that's the problem. I think we need to make sure that people have confidence in our electoral system. I think that's a basis of our one of the bases of our country. And I think if the photo ID would give people a better feel on the sense of security of our system and the legitimacy of our system. Because the worst thing that can happen is that people stop believing in our system itself.
Excluding eligible voters, especially people of low income and minorities, is not going to increase confidence in our voting system.
Okay, so let's get to the points of House Bill 194. And, you know, of course, let me know if I'm missing anything, Dan and Bob. It shortens the period of mail-in absentee voting from 35 days before the election to 21. So that's about, what is that?
2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. What's, I'll probably say this several times, what's the magic in 2 more weeks? What difference does 2 weeks make, Bob?
It doesn't. I mean, these individuals can start putting in applications for the actual absentee ballots starting in January. It's no, I mean, so there's no shortening of your ability to request a ballot. And let's face it, that's the important part here. The part of sending it in, I mean, when you get it, you look it over, you send it in when you want to send it in. It's not going to make a difference if you send it in 4 weeks before or 3 weeks before.
The magic behind this is that, and the reason why Republicans were so intent on adopting this law is that it closes the window for what is effectively same-day registration and voting between 35 and 30 days before the election. Under current law, before this bill was enacted, 35 days before the election, you were eligible to vote absentee, and you could register until 30 days before the election, which meant you could have one-stop shopping. You could go to your board of election, you could register and cast an in-person absentee ballot, which, if in fact you are eligible, would in fact be counted. This bill closes the window, and as I mentioned earlier, same-day registration is the one election reform that has systematically been shown to increase turnout, and closing that window is the main reason why the legislature voted to move the period from 35 days forward to 21.
There is an unintended consequence of the changes that took place earlier in 2005 was to allow for the quote-unquote golden week of 1 week where you could register and at the same day and vote at the same time. Now, everyone has agreed this wasn't the intent, and including the Democrat Secretary of State Jennifer Bruner said that should be changed. Okay,
but and, 2 weeks,
and that's what this bill changes. That I mean, we voted on this a while ago. People here in Ohio didn't want to have same day registration, and that's what this is getting. The Golden Week is taken care of by this, but that's not the only reason why this was done. This was done to create uniformity among all the county boards of elections and to like I said, it doesn't affect your requesting, and that's the important part here, not the sending in. It's the mere requesting of the ballot.
When you do same-day registration and voting, that's a provisional ballot, though, isn't it?
It's not exactly a provisional, but its functional effect is the same.
It will still only has to be verified.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, it will only be counted if you're verified, and if it's determined that you are not, in fact, an eligible voter, that ballot will not be counted.
But it's more importantly, there has been no law that was passed that dictated that we should have this 1 week. It just happened to occur because we have different time frames of when registration ends and when early voting starts.
You know, whether or not it was intended or not, I can't speak to what was in the legislature's mind in 2005. This is one of the best features of Ohio law, that we have this window for same-day registration and voting.
And it should
be noted that Jennifer Bruner is actually leading the effort to repeal HB 194, which, among other things, would have the effect of opening this window back
up. Why is it good? It's passing judgment, but why is it good that people who don't care enough to register to vote in advance get to on the day they're going to vote? What
it's good because, look, the reality is people like Bob and me, and a lot of your listeners, I'm sure, we pay close attention to politics. I'm seeing Bob nod his head. You know, I'm a political junkie just like he is, I'm sure you are as well, right? We pay close attention to politics in part because it's our business. But we got to remember, your average citizen has a lot of other things on his or her mind, especially in tough economic times. Look, they're worried about getting their kids to school, paying the rent, some people working two jobs. Not everybody is focused upon elections. And a lot of people, the reality is in our society, aren't focused on elections until very close to election season. You know, the last midterms elections nationwide, we had about 40% of eligible voters turning out. We have to recognize the reality that a lot of people aren't paying close attention to politics until relatively close to the election, and we must give those people an opportunity to participate if they get engaged. And that'll keep them as a part of the political process for future elections. Once you get them in, you know, the statistics show a lot of people tend to remain voting and active members of our electorate in the future.
Well, Dan, maybe we can come to a compromise here and say that if any individual who registers and votes the same day has to show a photo ID.
You know, I do think that some form of identification is appropriate for people who register on Election Day. In fact, that's what they
maybe
have.
Maybe make it a little higher.
Yeah, for people. And you know, Wisconsin, which has successfully run Election Day registration for many years, has a special identification requirement for people who register and vote on Election Day. So I don't object. You know, whether it has to be government-issued photo ID, we can debate that. But I'll concede the point that some form of heightened identification requirement is worth considering for Election Day registration. And so if you'll go to Election Day registration, I'm more than willing to do that deal, Bob.
And if only you guys ran the world, if you were only kings of the world. Marcia in Hillsborough, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Marcia.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I just want to make a comment, not necessarily about the bill, but for the convenience of using the mail-in ballot, as we are older people in Highland County, and the last couple of years they've consolidated so many voting areas. Ours used to be less than a mile away, now it's 13 miles away, and my husband also being disabled. But then there's another point about why people would want to use the mail-in ballot is that people who work far away from Highland County and drive a long way and not able to be off on the very day that they would need to vote. They'd be either driving to work or coming back.
Which is pretty common in Highland County because the jobs are so few.
Right.
And
one of the things that HB 194 did was prevented county boards of election from sending out absentee ballot applications on their own. This was done by a number of counties in the past election, especially counties like Cuyahoga and Franklin County, where we've tended to see very crowded polling places in the past. One of the good things about absentee voting, in-person or by mail, is that it takes pressure off the polls on Election Day. Now, I have to give credit to Secretary Husted again for reaching an agreement with Cuyahoga County.
Taking away Bob's idea.
You want to say,
I was going to talk about how he solved this problem for next year by saying that he's going to mail all 88 counties.
Which we have to take a break in a sec, but I wanted to bring that up. Okay, is that kind of it was not really a placebo, but is that giving us maybe a false sense of security, if there is such a thing, about it? Because that's for 1 year. For 1 year, he's going to do that. He's going to use some federal funds that he has available to send the absentee ballot applications out to everybody in the state. But that's just 1 year.
Which is the only fair thing to do. I mean, what he's trying to do here is ensure that Benton County is treated the same way as Cuyahoga County.
But what happens next year?
Well, that's something the legislature is going to have to deal with, or, you know, through federal funding or state funding, they can get some kind of. But we do have an inequity here. I'll tell you, Ann, if it was Delaware County and Claremont County and Warren County and Licking County that were sending them out, and the urban counties weren't, you'd be hearing a hue and cry from the unions and the Democrats and liberals that this is unfair ballot access.
Well, there's
and
other
all
unfair
that.
ballot access issues out there, and I think Marcia brought it up that in Hillsborough, where she lives in Highland County, they can't afford to have as many polling places as they used to have. So where's what about those kinds of inequities? I mean, are we ever going to have this completely equitable system, and particularly in a state like Ohio?
In theory, we should. And this is the problem. The poor rural counties are the ones that aren't mailing, and they're probably the ones that could probably use it the most.
And let me say, you know, I think we basically agree that if there are inequities, the best way of resolving them is to level up level up, don't level down. So increase access to the ballot so that more people can participate and can participate in a way that's convenient for them. Don't make it more difficult to vote in the way that HB 194 would do.
Thank you, Marcia, for that call. We are talking about House Bill.
Comment?
Sorry, Marcia, we got to take a break. I put you on hold, though. We're going to take a break. We're talking about House Bill 194. My guest, Dan Tokaji, teaches election law at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. Also, Bob Clegg, Republican strategist and senior vice president of Midwest Communications and Media. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
FM is your all-day NPR news station. Listen to local and national news all day, every day. And you can hear the best in classical music on Classical 101. Listen to your favorite composers 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. It's 89.7 NPR News and Classical 101 from WOSU Public Media. For more information, visit WOSU.org.
And this is 89.7 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of the program begins. And ahead of the president's visit to Columbus later today, we'll talk about his jobs bill and its impact on local small businesses here in Central Ohio. Join us for that discussion beginning at 11. And remember that you can discover more about our program at WOSU.org/allsides. On the show's website, you can listen and watch All Sides from 10 until noon every day and participate in the show through our live chat. Also, be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow Ann on Twitter at AnnFisherWOSU. Sunny skies today, a high of 85 degrees. There is a chance of showers and thunderstorms this evening. An overnight low of 56 degrees, sunny for Wednesday, and a high of 75. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking about House Bill 194. It's possible that you've seen petitions at your local farmers market on Saturdays or whatever day you go. They're all over the place. Wherever a crowd gathers, there is a petition out there for House Bill 194 to have it repealed. It'll go into effect if they don't gather enough signatures. It will go into effect on September 30th and impact the upcoming election as well as everyone thereafter until it is repealed, if and until it is repealed. Joining me today to talk about that, Bob Clegg, Republican strategist, senior vice president of Midwest Communications and Media. Also, Dan Tokaji, teaches law at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. He's also senior fellow at the Nonpartisan Election Law at Moritz Project. Questions or comments about House Bill 194, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, post your question or comment there. You can tweet me at AnnFisherWOSU. Let's move on. It cuts out three of the busiest days for in-person early voting from 2008. And at least in 2008, it was three of the busiest days, the Saturday, Sunday, and Monday before the election. Now, Marcia, one of the earlier callers, or it was Marcia, mentioned that a lot of people have to leave town and can't vote on election day. But other people think, well, yeah, that's fine, but this is ridiculous. It's just way too much access to the polls, and a lot of monkey shines can occur during those 3 days. What's the right ingredients? What's the right equation we're looking for as far as getting enough access?
Now, you know the intent, Ann, of why they cut that off. They cut that off so that the county boards – now, these – and we keep talking about the county boards. But, I mean, these are good, hardworking people that get overwhelmed – At election
time.
Well,
so do tax accountants at tax time.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind
of
the name.
And they do hire additional people, but they're also on much, much smaller budgets than they were before. And that time period allows for the county boards to update their poll books so that they're ready to go on election day so they know exactly who's voted, who hasn't voted, which then results in hopefully less provisional ballots being cast on election day that then have to be processed
out. Let me be the first to acknowledge that our election officials work very hard and have a difficult job to do. But we should keep in mind that our election laws are supposed to be written not for the convenience of government officials, but for the benefit of voters. And it's the voters' interest that should be considered first. These 3 days before the election, the Saturday, Sunday, and Monday before the Tuesday election day, tend to be the most heavily used days for early voting. And early voting in Ohio is a roaring success. This has been an incredibly successful program. We've had vote centers that make it easier for people to vote before the election. In contrast to mail-in voting, we don't have the same risks of fraud because people actually have to show up to vote early. This has been a roaring success. What I think Republicans are concerned about is that in 2008 in particular, it was predominantly Democrats, including African-Americans, who were using early voting in the days immediately before the
election. It was the big population centers where it was most popular.
That's right.
Right.
Well, if an individual cannot find the time to get themselves to a early voting location by the Friday before the election, then please. I mean, this is just about getting there. If you care enough to vote, then you get there in time.
And is it open on the weekends, the prior weekends before that?
So it's not just. But that's missing the big picture.
And you can also vote on election day.
Because the advantage of early voting is that it takes the. One of the big advantages of early voting is that it takes the pressure off the polls on election day. We've seen here in Franklin County in past years people waiting literally for hours to cast their votes in presidential elections. We've seen very crowded polling places at other times as well. We don't want to have a repeat on this. And one of the reasons why early voting is such a great thing is that it takes the pressure off the polls on election day without the risks that tend to accompany mail-in voting.
Mitchell in Dublin, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Thank you, gentlemen, for taking my call. I wanted to know how Bill 194 was going to affect early voting in the way of going. I went down to Vets Memorial and voted. And it was a huge crowd. I mean, it was awe-inspiring, really. How that's going to affect me and my wife being able to go down and vote early, you know, in person, like you were saying, because of the convenience, of course, you know, not being able to get off of work and vote on voting on election day. And I have not missed an election since I turned 18. So, you know, it's important to me, and I'm sure it's important to a lot of people. I just didn't know how it was going to affect people being able to do that. And, you know, being in that queue line through Vets was an awesome experience.
What day did you go to vote? How early did you vote? What day was that?
You know, I'm not quite sure. I wasn't sure. I'm not sure how it.
I remember those lines, but I can't remember if it was right before the election or if it was right when the early polls opened.
The answer to the question is that it will reduce the time that's available for in-person early voting, first of all, from 35 days before the election to 21, and it will most importantly exclude in-person early voting on the 3 days before the election where it tends to be most heavily used. In addition, there's a provision in the bill that limits the location for early voting to the Board of Elections unless the Board of Elections, by a majority vote, decides that it just can't practically be done there and it can happen elsewhere. Now, this presents real problems. We've got 4-member boards of elections, 2 Democrats, 2 Republicans. If members of one party decide it's to their political advantage to make early voting more difficult, we could have a real problem. I think the short answer is we don't know that a suitable location like Veterans Memorial will be available 2 years from now when we're really going to need in-person early voting if HB 194 is allowed to go into effect.
Well, I think that the provision to put that in there is the Secretary of State didn't want to have to be the one that always breaks those ties. And it's going to be to the advantage of the board to come to some kind of consensus on this. And I think they will. I mean, I don't think this is anything to do with trying to keep people from voting. It's just trying to agree on where you can do this, how many locations, and how much money that the county has to provide these locations.
Without assuming the motives of the folks that introduced and support House Bill 194, is there disagreement about the fact that it will affect the turnout, the overall turnout? You disagree with Dan, then, that it's
because
going to lower
with,
the number of votes?
Yeah, if you go in with the assumption that the Republicans are bad and they're trying to do this to suppress voting, sure, you're going to think that. But that was not the case. We got the administration of election law that has to take place. They're trying to make it uniform across all 88 counties, which currently it isn't.
And it's just an accident that these things happen to get passed on a strict party line vote, right?
And by the way, Mitchell in Dublin, thanks for that call. But then, Dan Tokaji, before we move on to some of these other elements of the bill, and I want to get to Sarah, who's a poll worker and waiting to talk to us. But what if it's a political issue, then are you saying that there's nothing that Democrats et al., the people who oppose House Bill 194, would do to reform the voting system to make it better?
You know, if I had the keys to the kingdom,
right,
what I would do is adopt election day registration. That is the one reform, as I mentioned before, that is statistically proven to increase turnout. There are some provisions of the bill that I don't object to. Like, for example, I should say I was party to or a lawyer in a lawsuit that challenged a requirement that naturalized citizens provide proof of their citizenship, but not natural born citizens, if challenged at the polls. This we challenged successfully on the grounds that it violated equal protection. A court struck that down. Well, the legislature included in this provision something that eliminates that provision. That doesn't have any practical event since that's already been struck down. So, you know, there are some things here and there. But on the whole, look, when you adopt a lot of changes to your election laws, you destabilize the system. Voters have to learn new rules. Poll workers have to learn new rules. We're just getting used to the last round of reforms in 2005. What we don't need right now is another major overhaul of our election system.
Abe sent an email. He opposes House Bill 194, but he also wants to hear about the part of the law where poll workers cannot help voters find the right polling place when they're confused about where to vote. And he wants to know what the possible justification for that is. And Sarah, you're a poll worker. You wanted to talk about that as well.
Yeah, I'm actually a voting location manager, and I should mention that I am not authorized to speak for the Board of Elections and purely addressing my own personal concerns.
Sure.
But one, my biggest concern is that I've now witnessed a couple of different polling locations, and boundaries were changed. They were just shifted by a couple of blocks or two, but people in both Democrats and Republicans were at the wrong location. And they were predominantly elderly and the younger, like married with children crowd, who really just don't have time to pay attention to those little flyers in the mail redirecting them to the correct polling location. And I would like to know, I mean, we haven't had our updated training as of yet. We have had some contact with the Board of Elections, at least I have. Mm-hmm. But I'm really concerned. That is, let me just give a... I don't have the numbers specifically. I did at some point, but my last precinct had about 2,000 registered voters. I had probably 60 people voted provisional ballot, and about 50 people needed to be redirected.
Yeah.
And so now you're saying that 194 does or doesn't give you the right. You're saying it takes away that right? I thought it,
That's what I understood.
Yeah, this is one of the most problematic features of the bill.
Yeah.
It doesn't take away the right. Here's it gives them the option of not doing it.
It gives them legal immunity because we currently have a lawsuit involving in Hamilton County, which is holding poll workers who inadvertently direct voters to the wrong location. It's putting those people in legal jeopardy. Now, we're talking about volunteers that work at polling locations, okay? We cannot leave them legally liable on this. The Secretary of State, John Husted, has said he will continue to work with the county boards to ensure that poll workers at the polling places will still continue to direct people to the correct polling places.
But if they're not sure.
But if they're not sure, they're not going to be held legally liable on that.
So, Dan, what— inaccurate. What the bill does is changes the word from shall to may, right?
Right.
Under current law, poll workers are required to direct voters to the right precinct if they show up at the wrong one. Now, this is a real problem because at many of our polling places, especially in larger counties like Franklin County and Cuyahoga County, we've got multiple precincts at the same polling place. And if you go to the wrong table, your vote will not count. What this changes it to is a discretionary rule where it's up to the poll worker to decide whether they like the looks of you, I suppose, maybe whether you're a Democrat or Republican, whether they will or will not direct you to the proper precinct. It presents the problem of arbitrary discretion and voters being treated
unequally. So what's
the solution then? I mean, the arbitrariness, how do you—
The solution was to leave the law exactly the same
way.
And it's
actually
totally inaccurate to suggest that poll workers are going to be facing some monetary liability if they don't direct poll workers to the right precinct.
But what about the fact that you could show up and what if they don't know, Dan, where the proper voting place is?
Well, poll workers, or if they're just guessing.
Poll
workers should know. But certainly if they do know that the voter is at the wrong precinct, then as current law requires, they should be directing them to the proper one. Now, if a poll worker is deliberately refusing to direct voters to the proper precinct and knowingly doing so, for example, because that person is African American, in that circumstance, I'll concede that they might not have immunity from legal liability. But generally speaking, if a poll worker makes a mistake, it's just fallacious to say that they're going to be required to pay a fine or be subjected to a lawsuit.
Dan, check out Hunter versus Hamilton County lawsuit. Then let's talk about
that. Injunctive relief case. Okay. It is not a damages case. Okay. Yes,
but poll workers should not be held legally liable, requiring poll workers
to follow the law. That's different
from
saying they're subjected to damages.
Where is voter responsibility here? You have no idea on voter responsibility.
This is about poll workers following the law and ensuring that voters are directed to the right precinct if they know they're at the
wrong one.
Assume that voting poll workers know everything that they're supposed to know.
There is no good reason for this law other than to make it more difficult for eligible citizens to vote and have their votes counted.
We're out of time. Okay, silence is golden right now. Thank you, Dan Tokaji.
Thank you. I should say, by the way, all the opinions expressed are solely my own, not those of the Ohio State University.
Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law Professor Dan Tokaji, thanks for joining us. Also, Bob Clegg, Republican strategist and Senior Vice President at Midwest Communications and Media. Thanks for joining us today. It was fun. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.